Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the situation in Syria is worsening. Secretary of State John Kerry is adamant. Tests on hair and blood samples show evidence Bashar Assad released sarin gas on a suburb of Damascus, killing nearly 1,500 people. President Barack Obama is pressing Congress to approve military strikes. 10 years ago, we found ourselves in a somewhat similar situation, covering the invasion of Iraq, followed weeks later by that now famous image of President George Bush under the Mission Accomplished banner. What have we learned since then about covering controversial military action? I'll ask our panelists. To many, David Frost was the British guy who got President Richard Nixon to apologize to the world during a series of intense interviews that were brought back into memory on the silver screen in the film Frost-Nixon. He died Saturday, suffering a heart attack while preparing to deliver a speech on the ocean liner, the Queen Elizabeth. We'll join journalists the world over in paying tribute. And from the traditional sit-down interview to Twitter, we'll discuss a paper made public this week written by a CNN political reporter that questions the relevance campaign journalism has in the age of social media. And are you ready for some football? Even if you're not a fan of the gridiron, the league is making some news again this week on several different fronts. It settled a lawsuit with players agreeing to pay out more than $700 million to treat head injuries. And in a somewhat tangential move that is going to be happy news to AFC fans in 8 Time Warner cable markets, they're going to be able to watch their favorite teams on Sunday now that CBS and the cable provider have struck a deal over subscriber fees. There's a lot more that we'll hopefully get to as well, but we're going to start with Syria. It's in a state of constant flux, but we do know this. The State Department claims it has proof that Bashar Assad's government unleashed sarin gas on its own citizens, killing almost 1,500 in suburban Damascus. President Barack Obama says the U.S. has no choice but to launch military strikes, yet he won't do it without a vote of support from Congress. Several top Republicans, including House Speaker John Boehner and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, say they support the strikes. Senator John McCain says he sees the need but wants to be assured that any action taken will go far enough to finish off the job.
Just to be candid with the American people, if the U.S. were to engage in military action in Syria, what are the chances that that's the end of it? I mean, is there any scenario in which the U.S. does not get more deeply and deeply involved?
Yes, you provide the weapons and you take out the air power that is the distinct advantage that Bashar Assad had. You commit to no American troops on the ground, and you can reverse this. The Free Syrian Army is viable, it's strong, and it's moderate, and anybody who tells you anything different isn't telling you the truth. We need to reverse the situation on the battlefield. It's an unfair fight. Russian weapons are pouring in, Iranian weapons are pouring in, and have no doubt this is a proxy war that the Iranians are the ones who will gain or lose by this.
I gotta leave it there, but at this moment, do you have confidence that this resolution will pass?
Say that again.
Do you have confidence that this will ultimately pass the Congress?
I hope so, but it's got to be a resolution that will achieve the goals that I just described. And if it doesn't, then I can't support it.
For journalists, there have been a lot of questions about how and where the evidence is coming from. Who is for a strike? Who is against it? There have been warnings from editors at major publications and the Associated Press to dig deeper ask for the evidence, find out where it's coming from, to question any claim of a slam dunk. That idea of the slam dunk, it's an allusion to George Tenet's reference to the supposed proof of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that led to the invasion there more than 10 years ago, followed by this now iconic image of President George Bush standing under the Mission Accomplished banner aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln in May of 2003. The last troops didn't actually leave Iraq until 8 years after that. What are we seeing in the coverage of Syria and what's been going on in the past 3, 4, 5 days, even the past couple of weeks, that's the same? What's been different than what we saw a decade ago?
I mean, I do think that it's a good lesson that we learned to try to do a better job of verifying what the intelligence is, or at least to ask questions about the intelligence. That's a value that we did learn from Iraq. I am worried, though, that we now want to color everything with this notion of not just verify, but they lie to us, that that's the new frame, that the government officials are constantly playing us. Well, yes, of course they're constantly playing us. That's been true for wars or any other political situation. But I do think we ought to look at the evidence and be willing to accept it, and that the public, frankly, ought to look at the coverage and say, okay, the president's come to Congress, given us a little more time to look at this. We can examine the evidence and not just decide whether we should bomb Syria based on our own sort of worldview or our own partisan politics.
Yeah, I think the other issue you have here is whether or not the media is doing a very effective job of informing the public and educating the public. One of the issues during the war in Iraq was that the public just didn't know enough about what was going on, or even the players involved. And I think that's even more highlighted here in this situation. There are so many players involved in this. You've got Russia, you've got the United Nations, you've got the Iranians, you also have the Iraqis as well, which they're getting very little talk about their involvement in this. And then you've got President Obama and Congress involved. So I think the media owes the public a lot more education on this issue than they're giving right now.
So how do you go about doing that?
I think you can do that by continuing to bring up all the players involved. You can't leave them out, because you can say, okay, President Obama goes to Congress, he's asking for permission. Well, okay, if he gets the permission, where does Russia stand in this? Where do the Iranians stand in this? What about the factions that are fighting in Syria right now? One of the things that people have not talked very much about is that among the rebels in Syria, there are elements of al-Qaeda involved in that. And are they going to be able to get their hands on weapons if this thing escalates past the bombing into something more? It's questions that need to be asked.
You'd like to hope that the media and the public would be a little more rational in considering the arguments. And so far, I've actually been, I have a positive view of the debate that's been going on. It's cross political lines. People are asking tough questions. But then again, this is a difference between Syria and Iraq. Iraq, rightly or wrongly, was a response to an existential threat to the U.S. with the 9/11 bombing. No matter how you want to see the horrible humanitarian crisis that is killing people with poison gas, I don't think you can make the same sort of direct emotional argument about its direct impact on the U.S. So we should have time to the media and the public to consider all of the facts and all of the angles to this.
And I also think that there needs to be, we're talking about this in the framework of Iraq. I think we need to talk about this in the framework of what happened in Rwanda, what happened in Bosnia during those crises, because those two crises mirror what's happening here more than what happened in Iraq.
And talk a little bit about what you mean by that, because those may be a little further back.
Those are
memories.
Further back. Well, Rwanda was a genocide situation in which the world basically stood by and allowed this civil war to happen. And there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of Rwandans that were killed in a mass genocide. And then when you talk about what happened in Bosnia, that was the breakup of Yugoslavia. It was also a civil war in which you also had civilians that were killed in massive numbers, and the world stood by and didn't do anything until the latter stages of that. And it took action on the part of President Clinton to step in and say, we're going to stop this genocide. And I think that's the approach that President Obama is trying to take now. The only difference is that he's going to Congress and asking for permission, whereas in the other situations, the president just acted unilaterally under the War Powers Act.
I do think there's an interesting comparison with Iraq that not a lot of people have been writing about, at least that I haven't seen, and that's the notion that, well, there was an opportunity when Saddam Hussein gassed his own people, the Kurds, that if we had responded then the way that the the president is saying he'd like to respond in Syria, it might, and I underline that big red, it might have changed the whole course of our involvement in Iraq later.
Well, for journalists working in Syria, the whos, the wheres, the hows, and the whys, they're very hard to pin down. Reporters are being expelled from the country, which is making their jobs even harder. Those allowed in may only be able to work in Damascus, away from the conflict. CNN's Peter Pleitgen is in Beirut and is having his visa from Syria. It's been revoked by the Assad government.
If you use video and comments that are from the other side, from the opposition side, that's something that they're very touchy about. Now, of course, this time was really a special situation. I can't even tell you how different the mood was in comparison to other times with this whole thing with chemical weapons looming over there. They're very, very touchy about that subject. They're very touchy when you get firsthand accounts, and we were able to get some from the areas where all of this happened. We were actually able to send a crew into the areas where all this happened, to the Ghouta area, and get video back. That's something that where they're very, very touchy about it, because they sense that this is an issue that will cause something big internationally. I mean, we've seen the reaction from the U.S., and they were just sensing how vital and how high the stakes were for all of this.
So Pleitgen is still continuing to do a lot of his reporting as best he can from Beirut, but went on to say on reliable sources on CNN that there are challenges that come with that, that he's having to rely a lot on social media, on YouTube, in trying to communicate with people who are on the ground. Talk a little bit about the kinds of challenges that come to a journalist trying to report that far remotely.
Well, I think one of the key challenges is you just can't get in. And that's what they're facing right now, because they're known by government officials and that sort of thing. If they come into the country, then they could be stopped. They could be jailed for being there illegally, especially if their visas have been revoked. So that's one of the other issues. The other issue is that when you're using social media, it's very difficult to verify this information. You don't know where it's coming from. So that's the other issue. You can't just put it up on the air, because you're going to be held liable and your credibility is going to be damaged if it's finds out that it's not credible information.
So, Mike, if you find yourself in that kind of a situation, how do you verify something that you're reporting on from a country or two or three away?
I mean, I do think that's very difficult. And he described in the interview, which you've got posted on our blog, in more detail about how he developed a network of sources on all sides and how he tries to derive some level of truth or verification by comparing all those accounts. But with social media, that is really difficult. I mean, it's great that you have all these sources of additional documentation that journalists themselves can't get, but it's very easy to fake videos on YouTube. And it's not always as obvious as seeing a photoshopped image or whatever. So that's a very hard job to do, to compare that evidence and say, did it really happen in that place at that time? It's not usually shot by professional videographers, so there's some question about the lighting or the angle or whatever. It's very hard to do.
So if you were offering advice to the news consumer at home, do you believe what you see that's coming out of there if the reporter can't be on the ground in the place where it's happening?
Well, what you're looking for is whether or not the reporter is being transparent about where he or she got that information and how it was obtained. And if they're doing that part of it, then the viewer has some semblance of knowledge of what's going on and the context behind it. But if they're not being truthful about, here's how we obtained this, here's what this is, we can't verify this or we can verify this, then you know, all bets are off.
At least in the Middle East, you have news organizations who have had journalists based there for some time. Even when they've cut back in many other parts of the world, they still have people who are experts there, who are grounded there, who can probably be relied upon, as you know, with the evidence they have, to tell the story well. But I am worried in other parts of the world where there have been deep cuts in news organizations, and then you have to parachute somebody in there and try to figure out what's really going on the ground. And I also worry that when we talk about trying to figure out what the evidence shows and our government claiming that it shows that, you know, somebody's been poisoned or whatever, I don't think the Obama administration, at least until the past few days in their talk, has been any more transparent than any other previous administration in sharing exactly those details of that intelligence.
And I think part of the problem with that is that they have operatives on the ground and they have eyes and ears. And I think they're concerned about whether or not they're going to put those people in danger because of the way in which they're gathering their information. But that being said, if they're going to ask that they're going to ask the American public, or the representatives of the American public, those in Congress, to vote up or down on whether or not to have an action against Syria, then they need to be more forthcoming about the information that they've obtained.
Well, social media, such as YouTube and Twitter, help get the word out for sure. Social has been a driving force in changing the way we do our jobs in almost every respect. Political reporter Peter Hamby spent the spring working at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University. They just released the results of his examination of reporting on modern political races in today's online media ecosystem. Ernest, tell us a little bit about what that paper revealed.
Well, I think what it's showing is that social media, in particular Twitter, is playing a larger role in political campaigns. And what I'm concerned about is whether or not it's providing more contextual information as opposed to just the 40 characters. That's something that I think that needs further study. But if Twitter and Facebook and those operations are going to be a part of modern political campaigns and journalists are going to use them, then I think they need to come up with a much more effective way of doing that instead of just sending out material.
I don't think the author was saying this per se, but when people draw the conclusion from his paper that somehow Twitter is a cause of the problems in the way we've covered the past campaign. No, I think it's more of a symptom. I mean, I think it's true that there was a lot of shallowness in the reporting and the sort of the velocity of reporting. You know, every few minutes we're going to tweet the latest whatever.
Right. And it was the update of the horse race as opposed to the issues that...
It led to even more process reporting than we've seen and we've had people complain about in past presidential campaigns. But again, I think it's a symptom, not the cause.
But to me, it's one of those things where we've found a new a new gadget, and we're going to use that to produce the same kind of journalism.
Shiny
that
new thing
produced.
Syndrome.
Exactly. And and in order for that to change, you're going to have to change the culture of the way in which political campaigns are run, but also the way in which journalists cover political campaigns.
I thought, frankly, that one of the more interesting things that was in that report, the bigger problems was the relative youth of the people and inexperience of the people assigned to cover the campaigns, whether they would be field producers or sort of embeds from local affiliates or whatever. We don't have the same degree of political sophistication and background knowledge among the folks that were out there on the bus. It's more expensive to cover it that way. Now, on the other hand, I can also argue it from the standpoint in the good old days, it was very insular. We had a few reporters who, had these special relationships with the politicians and not necessarily with their audience. So I can see the way we're covering it today could also be a net positive.
And the campaigns themselves are making it much more difficult because they figured out ways to go around the traditional media to get to the audiences that they're trying to reach.
They have access to Twitter and to YouTube and everything just as easily. Right. And they have then a direct connection to their supporters.
Right. And they're putting it through their filter and not necessarily the filter of traditional journalists. And I think that's something that the industry itself, that the news media itself is going to have to deal with more and more as we move into bigger and more expensive campaigns.
I'm just not sure that the campaigns are afraid of traditional journalists and therefore using Twitter and other means to go around them. I just think that the public, through its use of social media, has basically said, we don't trust the traditional news sources to give us everything we want to know about politics. That's on us as much as it is on the campaign.
And it also feeds into the partisan nature of our politics, too, because people can go to the source of information that sort of backs up what they already believe, and they can just bypass any kind of objective sort of information.
Well, I think one of the most important courses we teach here at the School of Journalism is one that you sometimes teach, Ernest, the History of Journalism course. And as I tell our students, you don't know where you're going if you don't know how we got here. And that's what makes that course so important. Well, our industry lost one of the greats this week, David Frost. Most Americans outside of journalism know the Brit is the man who grilled disgraced former President Richard Nixon in a series of 12 interviews over a decade, culminating in this 1977 an apology to the American people.
I'm sorry. I just hope I haven't let you down. Well, when I said I just hope I haven't let you down, that said it all. I had. I let down my friends. I let down the country. I let down our system of government and the dreams of all those young people that ought to get into government, but will think it's all too corrupt and the rest. Most of all, I let down an opportunity that I would have had for 2.5 more years to proceed on great projects and programs for building a lasting peace.
It's quite the juxtaposition from I am not a crook. What is it that made David Frost so good at what he did?
I think his willingness to ask the tough questions. I mean, before this interview, before these series of interviews that he put together, I mean, there was this sort of deference that you had to political leaders, especially the President of the United States, and even former presidents. And he had the ability to continue to ask those questions over and over again, because these were a series of interviews that he did with Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the fourth interview that he actually got this statement. And he was willing to stay in the room and challenge the former president about what he did during that time in the White House.
David Frost was a great interviewer, but before we sort of canonize him, I would suggest there were some other things that he had going for him, too, that are a little different from him being, you know, the sainted journalist. One, he was underestimated, because Nixon thought he was going to be a sympathetic interview. Why? Well, let's see. David Frost paid him $600,000, plus offered him 20% of any royalties from syndicating the interviews. That was something that you wouldn't imagine happening today. Also, the interview happened, what, 2-3 years after the resignation, mm-hmm. So it wasn't in the heat of sort of the resignation cycle. So Nixon had reasons to want to be more human in his response. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I mean, it was a great interview, but I think part of it had to do with paying for the interview, and part of it had to be, you know, he was underestimated. He was thought to be a softball interview.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think that the reason why Nixon and his people agreed to that was because they didn't think he would ask those tough questions. But I would like to give Frost credit for the fact that he did do it under duress, because there were those within his inner circle that didn't want him to ask those tough questions for fear that they wouldn't be able to get those interviews on television.
Another thing I'd say about, because I don't want people to get the impression that I don't think highly of what David Frost did. He was a great journalist in many ways. But in some ways, it's the same problem of us trying to, you know, give sainthood to some of the Edward R. Murrow. Think about him. He did some great journalism, but he also interviewed celebrities. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did the people on 60 Minutes, the same thing. If you look at Oprah or Larry King, all these, they had their great moments, but they also believed in the business of broadcasting and the profit motive and interviewing celebrities and all the things that we still see on TV news today.
Well, since we're talking about the business and the profit motive, there has been a change and an addition to our local news scene this week. KMIZ, Mid-Missouri's ABC affiliate, launched a new noon newscast this week. It signals for the first time, and how long would you guys say that all three network affiliates have a midday show?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either. Maybe way back in the day when I was a student here, but no, this is the first time in a long time when all three of them had noon newscasts.
Right. You think there's an appetite for it in our market?
I'm not sure whether there's an appetite for it, but I know that it definitely saves them some money, because it's a whole lot easier to produce a newscast than it is to pay for another Oprah or
Anderson Cooper or Rachel Ray or whatever.
Or Katie
it is.
Kirk or whoever else has a show out there. And I think that's one of the reasons that they decided to go with it. Now, whether or not there's enough news out there to warrant all of these newscasts, I'm not sure.
I don't know whether there is a market for it now, but local TV executives need for there to be a market for it, because if you think about local television going forward, they're no longer going to be they aren't now the only vehicles for carrying network programming. Their only reason for existence is to provide local content. So the more they can do that, the more they can offer different programs at different times that feed different appetites, the better they're going to be. And the other thing I'd say about this is, look at how Channel 17 under new ownership has really upped the game for everybody in this market.
Absolutely. It's created some strong competition there.
I agree with that.
Last week, we spent a great deal of time talking about a breakup of sorts between Frontline and ESPN. They'd been working together on a documentary on the NFL's handling of concussions and traumatic brain injury among current and former players. ESPN dropped out, citing concerns about a lack of editorial control. Some speculated the network was being pressured by the league to back out. Well, there's movement this week as the league settled a lawsuit brought by more than 4,500 retired players seeking damages for treatment for long-term care from concussions and other injuries that were incurred on the field. The league and NFL properties agreed to pay out $765 million over the next 20 years. Let's talk about the timing of this for just a second. ESPN drops out of the Frontline documentary. There's reporting in the New York Times that ESPN and the NFL, that management from both organizations had met over a contentious lunch. And then there's suddenly a settlement. The timing of that seems strange to anybody?
Well, the timing is strange, but I also think that if you go and you read the stories that have come out since the settlement, that the judge in the case was basically saying that certain parts of it were going to be thrown out, which were going to hurt the players. Certain parts of it were going to be kept, which was going to hurt the league. It was in the best interest of both parties to settle this. And I think that the NFL definitely wanted it off the table before the start of the season, because they didn't want to have week after week after week of NFL shows leading off with this concussion lawsuit. So I think for all parties concerned, you know, selling it now was the right thing to do.
My biggest concern about the timing is that perhaps now there'll be less of an audience for the Frontline documentary. There'll be less interest in stories about concussions and other injuries, and not just in professional sports, but in amateur sports as well. And I just hope we don't take our eye off the ball on this problem. Certainly the league wants us to stop talking about it and talk about football. I hope journalists will continue to talk about this impact on the larger society.
Well, I don't necessarily think it's going to go away, because right before we taped the show, I was looking online, and now there are a group of players who are about to sue the NCAA over similar issues of concussion. So I think it's not going to go away.
Well, also, just in time for the football season, just as predicted, the networks of CBS, including Showtime and the Smithsonian Channel, have returned to the Time Warner cable network. So just in time, football will be back on TV this coming Sunday. Remember a few weeks ago, we had talked about Al Roker and how he had overslept and missed part of his morning show, Wake Up with Al, on the Weather Channel? Well, I guess it could have been worse.
He's really asleep.
I don't think we're being good co-hosts right now.
Good to see you. Welcome to Fox and Friends.
I know we're not on television, so
no.
It doesn't bother me.
No need to be embarrassed.
No. Is this commercial, honestly, live?
Yeah.
In the 15 years of this program, I don't think that's ever happened.
I know.
Poor Tucker Carlson. He had a quick turnaround subbing Friday night on Hannity and then having to be back on set bright and early Saturday morning for Fox and Friends. Producers had some fun at Carlson's expense, replaying it later in the show with the song Sweet Dreams playing in the background. Luckily, we're not here too early in the morning, you guys. But if that ever happens...
Oh, we promise.
No, okay, very good. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. But before we go, I want to take a moment to recognize you, Ernest, and congratulate you. This morning, Ernest was recognized with the 2013 National Award for Excellence in Teaching by the American Journalism Historians Association. Each year, the award honors a college or university teacher who excels at teaching in the areas of journalism or mass communication history, makes a positive impact on student learning, and offers an outstanding example for other educators. Ernest, I speak for myself, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Mike, too, when I say they could not have chosen a more deserving recipient this year.
Thank you very much.
So
I appreciate
it. Thank you. And thank you for listening and watching today. There's more background on today's topics on our Links blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also watch the show and leave comments for us there, or send them via email to views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. Mike, Ernest, and I will be here with another edition of Views of the News.